The Ask NT Writes Anything podcast is back.
Hello, this is Tom Wright speaking to you from my study here in Oxford in England. I'm really looking forward to the fact that Mike Bird and I are relaunching the Ask NT Write Anything podcast, looking at key questions that people have sent in, but also developing some themes that he and I have been interested in and we're eager to talk about with one another.
Listen today on your chosen podcast provider and head to asknt.com to submit your question. The Ask NT Writes Anything podcast is back.
Hello, this is Tom Wright speaking to you from my study here in Oxford in England. I'm really looking forward to the fact that Mike Bird and I are relaunching the Ask NT Write Anything podcast, looking at key questions that people have sent in, but also developing some themes that he and I have been interested in and we're eager to talk about with one another.
Listen today on your chosen podcast provider and head to asknt.com to submit your question.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Thank you for listening to the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources and podcasts. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis Podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it.
Before we dive into today's episode, I want to quickly let you know about an exciting event that we've got coming up with Professor Alistair McGrath in Oxford. On Wednesday the 5th of February, I will be recording a live episode of the show with Alistair, which will include an exciting opportunity for you to ask him your own questions. The title of the event is The C.S. Lewis You Never Knew, Exploring Meaning, Truth and Technology, and it will be held at Wycliffe Hall in Oxford at 5:30 p.m. Tickets are free, but they do need to be booked in advance, and there are details of how to do that in the show notes. Alistair and I would love you to join us on Wednesday the 5th of February at Wycliffe Hall in Oxford at 5:30 p.m.
But now for today's show.
In this episode, we're going to be hearing from Dr. Sarah Waters, an assistant professor of language and literature at Sterling College, Kansas, and a specialist in William Shakespeare and C.S. Lewis. She's published numerous academic papers and is working on a new book about Lewis and Shakespeare. Among other things, in this conversation, Sarah's going to be sharing some of the context for a paper that she presented at the 2024 Undiscovered C.S. Lewis Conference, which was held at George Fox University. The title of Sarah's paper was An Undiscovered Source in Lewis's Conversion Narrative. Sarah, you're an expert in Shakespeare as well. Do we know much about Shakespeare's religious beliefs?
Not exactly, which has led to a huge amount of speculation about this. So there's you can read very convincing narratives about whether he was a Catholic or whether he was a Protestant. And religion is very complicated in Shakespeare's period, or Christianity is very complicated in Shakespeare's period. So obviously, Henry VIII has come along, and there's been that massive break with the Catholic Church, and the Church of England under the new kind of version of Protestantism. And so by the time Shakespeare's writing, he has two monarchs on the thrones. There's Elizabeth I, who holds very strictly to the Protestantism of her father. And then there's James I and VI, and he is from a more Catholic background. This is very contentious, hence plays like Macbeth that talk about regicide. And so there's a lot of kind of fraught behavior going on in terms of religion. So it would have been illegal for Shakespeare to be outright Catholic. Right. That does not necessarily mean that he didn't necessarily hold some views that we would align with Catholicism today. His wife, we know, is from a Catholic background. So there's some kind of speculative work on the extent to which that would have impacted him. He certainly uses imagery from both Catholicism and Protestantism. And he quite frequently sets his plays in the famously Catholic Italy.
Sarah, let's talk about C.S. Lewis's conversion, because the title for your paper at the conference was An Undiscovered Source in C.S. Lewis's Conversion Narrative. And we're going to hear your paper a little bit later. But why did you pick that title? And I guess the underlying question behind all of that is, why do you think Shakespeare actually played a significant role in Lewis's conversion?
Yeah, thank you. I picked the title partly because the conference premise was that you had to pick something that had been undiscovered in some way. Now, I have to say that this had been sitting there in plain sight. It's just no one had written about it. I had a kind of moment of discovery myself of this when I was simply reading through a couple of letters actually to prepare for another talk in 2023. And it occurred to me as I was reading letters where I knew there were references to Shakespeare plays. Hang on a second. These two letters are just before Lewis announces to Greaves that he has passed on into Christianity. And I had this sort of moment of shock, and I kind of wanted to convey some of that in the title itself. But I think part of it is also that we sort of think those who have read, you know, a few Lewis biographies or have some kind of vague understanding of Lewis's life trajectory, basically think we know his conversion narrative. And so we don't necessarily look back at those letters, which are really instrumental just before. And we maybe just know his conversion narrative through something like Surprised by Joy as well, where he doesn't really talk so much about Shakespeare. We know the influence of things like George MacDonald because he talks about this, and you'll hear Baptize My Imagination banded about any Lewis conference, as it should be. But my contention was that as well as MacDonald and as well as William Morris, who he talks quite a lot about in these letters just before, he also talks about two Shakespeare plays. And in drawing on those, he talks about these plays as myths. And we know that the idea of kind of myth becoming fact and the idea of these pagan narratives, or quote unquote pagan narratives, having grains of truth, of myths of dying and rising gods, was so important to him in those Addison Walt discussions and in the discussions he was having with Tolkien and Dyson at the time, that it seems really interesting that he groups Shakespeare in that same kind of narrative of these are myths that suddenly to me became much more than myth. And in the letter where he talks about his late night walk with Dyson and Tolkien, he mentions one Shakespeare play. And then the letter just before that to Greaves, he mentions another Shakespeare play. And it's in the third letter in the series, if you like, where he says to Greaves, I've just passed on into believing in Christianity. So he already believes in God at this point, right? But it's this kind of theism. He hasn't moved to Christianity at this stage. Yeah, there's a practical reason why he's talking about these Shakespeare plays, which is that he's preparing to teach them. But also, he is rereading them as well, and finding more than just, oh, great, there's a nice little textual link I can make to my students.
So what were those two plays, Sarah?
Oh, yeah. So so he talks about The Winter's Tale, and he talks about Hamlet, in that order.
And does he draw on particular elements within the play, or is he just sort of saying generally that they inspired?
No, and that's a really interesting thing. So with Winter's Tale, he talks about one particular scene in that play. So he talks about the scene right near the end of the play where Hermione, who is the much abused wife of Leontes, who we believe to be dead, there's a statue of Hermione that is revealed in this scene. And Lewis talks about the impact of that statue upon him, which previously he had thought was kind of just artifice. And now he saw that that statue coming to life was much more significant. And he talks about how these myths, these mythical stories, have so much more when they have that kind of essence of something beyond within them. And when he's talking about Hamlet in the next letter, he talks about how Hamlet has the sense of grace that we see in that play, as well as the importance of death. And he says, have you read Hamlet at all recently? If not, do and just surrender yourself to the magic. And so there's very much this kind of just sheer joy that he has, but also the hit of the impact of death is also super important to him as he's thinking about these things as well.
Sarah, you're obviously a Shakespeare scholar and you're very well versed in Lewis. Do you see, we've obviously talked a little bit about Hamlet already, but do you see elements of both of those plays in his writings sort of peppered throughout his work?
Yeah, and sometimes these are explicit, sometimes less so. Hamlet gets name checked in the silver chair. We have statues coming to life in the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. I don't think these are sort of sheer chance escapades. And he writes, he doesn't really publish on The Winter's Tale, but he does publish on Hamlet. So I think these are plays that sort of stuck with him. In the mid-1930s, he engages in a really kind of technical debate with key Shakespeare scholars about Hamlet. So he's doing the sort of academic side of working on these things as well, but also enjoying them as stories, which he's very, very keen on as a kind of general approach in his criticism, but also very explicitly with Shakespeare, because he had this bad experience of, you know, people say, we should read it this way, and he didn't want to read it that way. And that was especially reading it through this kind of means of character criticism, which was big at the time, which was basically, let's take Hamlet out of the play. No, Hamlet lives in the play. And he actually literally does take Hamlet out of the play to put him in Narnia, which is kind of interesting.
Sarah, well, one of the things you mentioned was Hugo Dyson in that Addison Walk conversation at Magdalen College at Oxford. And I think historically we've tended to slightly downplay Hugo Dyson's right. impact, and we talk more about Tolkien's impact on myth and the conversations they had. Mm-hmm. Why do we downplay Hugo Dyson's impact on that conversation?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because when you look at the way that Lewis talks about it, he actually mentions Dyson first, right? Which, I mean, that might just be sort of sheer chance, but he does. I think in part it's because historically people working on the Inklings, and specifically working on Tolkien was much more popular. He published a lot more. Dyson didn't publish huge amounts. And Tolkien also wrote up his version of the narrative as a poem, which then his biographer and then the person who also wrote the sort of first book on the Inklings, Humphrey Carpenter, used as the basis for the way that he framed the Addison's Walk discussion. So I think it's sort of lodged in people's minds that Tolkien was really important in that he wrote this poem about it afterwards. And he's the kind of primary source. Dyson didn't write, or at least unless someone can discover it, which would be great, I hope they do, he doesn't seem to have written about that encounter. So I think it's partly like Tolkien sort of blowing his own horn and then people taking that and his reputation as well, whereas Dyson was a really well-revered tutor amongst his students, but he didn't publish huge amounts. And so I think that sort of has had an impact as well.
But he did have a really significant contribution, didn't he? Why was he so important in that conversation?
Well, Dyson was primarily, at least, a Shakespeare scholar. And so it seems to me at least not that unlikely that amongst their many conversations that night, amongst hours and hours, where Lewis says they talked about literary texts as well, it seems not that unlikely, particularly by the time Tolkien goes home, that Dyson and Lewis, who then carry on talking, might have also mentioned Shakespeare in that narrative. And also, people say that Tolkien didn't like Shakespeare. That's based on some kind of slightly strange readings of some very particular things in his writing. It's true that he didn't like some aspects of Shakespeare, but it wouldn't be totally out of the picture that maybe they might have mentioned Shakespeare while Tolkien was still there. But certainly it seems like if Lewis is reading these plays, he might have said to Dyson, hey, I'm reading Hamlet at the moment. I noticed this thing. Isn't that interesting? It doesn't seem totally out of the question.
And that certainly wasn't the only conversation that Dyson and right. Lewis had, was it?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And they'd not met that. They'd met, I think it was the year before, so they hadn't known each other that long, but every time they met, they had these really extended, long, late night conversations. That seemed to be kind of what they did. And also Lewis went to stay with Dyson as well. So they're not just meeting in Oxford. Dyson at the time is teaching at the University of Reading, so he's not in Oxford sort of as regularly as someone like Tolkien, but he was, when he was in Oxford, he was attending the Inklings meetings and so on. So yeah, there's a lot more interactions between Lewis and Dyson than I think credit has been given in the sort of way that we frame the conversion story.
One of the elements you've already mentioned is mythic emphasis, the great myth. What did myth mean to Lewis, and why was that such a significant element of his conversion, do you think, Sarah?
So he was really, really interested in stories that particularly featured dying and rising gods. Now, this particularly was true in Norse mythology, but more broadly too, and stories that kind of brought you to the edge of the precipice and then pulled you back. I mentioned William Morris earlier, but he writes about that there too, and he says, you know, he's doing something and showing you the delight of a world that he doesn't believe in. And so even before, Lewis is thinking about these kinds of questions. But he's interested in the possibility of these myths, of the these dying rising gods represent. But he doesn't think they're true. He just thinks they're an interesting story trope, right? They have a huge emotional impact on him. He's really moved when he reads these narratives, but he doesn't believe them. Because they're pagan stories, that's how he sees them to be. And so the kind of huge turning point, which Lewis then writes about in his letter to Greaves afterwards, but Tolkien writes about also, was essentially, well, these stories that you love, that's what Christianity is. It's a story of a dying and rising God, except it's true, right? This God really did come to earth, live, die and rise again. You love that narrative when you find it anywhere else, but when you find it in the Gospels, somehow that's kind of obnoxious to you. And so Lewis's big maneuver is, okay, well, that's true, and that's a story that I love. Wow, okay. And so myth become fact. That's what people mean when they're talking about that. And Lewis writes an essay, of course, with myth become fact.
And was there anything that you think Dyson potentially added to that conversation? Because I guess we've seen Tolkien talk about that and the youth catastrophe and all of that. But is there any element that Dyson added to that conversation about why myth was such an important factor?
Well, I think we see some of this later on when we look at some of the very few published works that Dyson has, which are around Shakespeare. And he talks about tragedy and the kind of moving power of tragedy, and I suspect that there's something of that in the narrative as well. And you hear in some of Dyson's obituaries, some of his students talked about how when we read Lewis's version of his narrative, his conversion narrative, there's a kind of flavor of Dyson about them, and part of that I think is the way he kind of frames argument, but also I wonder if there's a degree to which that tragedy as seen in literature comes to life, and also there's hope beyond that tragedy. So the way that Dyson writes about this later, whether it was Lewis influencing him later on or the vice versa, is harder to say, but I suspect that those were ideas that they were discussing at the time as well.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too. Before we get back to today's show, I want to introduce you to Christopher Gasson, who has a new book about finding God in atheist books. Christopher, what inspired you to write The Devil's Gospels?
I was running a teenage discussion group at Oxford's University Church when I decided that the best way to help them build their faith upon a rock was to tackle atheism head on. Each month we explored a different atheist book. I found two things. First, these writers, like Dawkins and Nietzsche, aren't really a threat to God. They're mainly angry about how the church has interpreted Jesus' teaching, and I think we can learn from that. Second, I found that the grown-ups in the church also really wanted better answers to atheist challenges.
So do you think we can become better Christians by reading atheist books?
That's the paradox, but I think it's very much in line with what the university church is all about. Oxford University was founded on the principle that everything that we can learn about the world will deepen our understanding of God. That's as true today as it was 900 years ago, and it applies as much to science as it does to the humanities, and indeed atheism.
So, Christopher, where can we find the book?
The Devil's Gospels is available on Amazon and in all good bookshops. Otherwise, head to thedevilsgospels.com where you can find more details.
Thank you, Christopher. And now back to today's show.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation. We've obviously talked a little bit about Shakespeare's religious beliefs not being so easy to pin down, but are there any obvious religious ideas in his plays? And is it clear why they were significant for Lewis and how he perhaps used some of those in his own writing?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the reasons there's so much speculation about Shakespeare and religion is that he's quite hard to pin down in terms of what he, not necessarily exactly what he believes, but also the way that he frames that belief, right? So, for example, in The Merchant of Venice, some of the most moving lines are given by Shylock, who, of course, is demonized by the Christian characters in that play. And Portia talks of mercy, but she talks of mercy with a motive behind it, and isn't necessarily the best of the characters. And I think one of the things that Shakespeare at least is getting his audience to think about is, what does it mean to actually practice what you preach versus simply be a kind of Pharisee sort of character? And I think with Lewis too, often it's not quite so kind of clear cut. So Edmund seems like a terrible character, right? You know, he's going through some stuff. He's clearly going through stuff at the beginning. I understand it. However, we have this hugely redemptive moment, and he doesn't become perfect after that, but he certainly becomes much more likable. And of course, we're perhaps beginning The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, we think, oh, yes, I quite like Lucy, actually. But we all know really deep down we're much more like Edmund than we want to admit. And I think that's one of the things that they're both getting us to think about. Here are some kind of representations of more sort of purely moral and upright standing characters. And here are some who claim to be and are not, and they're kind of hypocritical ones. And here are some who are just so pure evil. As well. And so I think Shakespeare's harder to pin down because he gives these different portraits of different kinds of versions of good and bad Christianity. So we have that in Measure for Measure later on as well. And he is interested in the dramatic potential of Christianity, whatever he believed, I think, is fair to say.
Sarah, I know you've co-edited a volume of An Unexpected Journal with Joe Rickey exploring Shakespeare and cultural apologetics, but where does Lewis draw on Shakespeare in his apologetics, if at all, do you think?
Yeah, so the example I mentioned from King Lear earlier, I'll talk, I guess, a little bit more about that. In that issue that I co-edited, there's an article that I have sort of specifically talking about that. In that use of King Lear, one of the things he's thinking about is how Lear is absolutely obsessed with affection. And he talks about how that goes kind of beyond need love, right? He has this deep desire for affection, and he goes about it the wrong way. If you want someone to show their love for you, don't go up to them and say, please tell me how much you love me, because that's something you're asking to quantify something, right? That's just not how it works. We all, of course, know this from personal experience, for better or for worse. But Lewis, in using Lear, kind of shows us an example of someone who is absolutely getting it wrong, and then sees the tragedy of the impact of that getting it wrong. So at the end of King Lear, his daughter Cordelia, who sort of comes to save him after his kingdom has been basically absolutely destroyed by his two daughters who claimed to love him, he dies, she dies, and is deeply, deeply moving. And he realizes way too late that actually he should have cared more about other people. And he talks about how he should have given more care to the poor in his kingdom and so on. And these are journeys he has to go on. And so one of the things I argue in terms of Lewis's use of Shakespeare and his apologetics is he'll mention a play or he'll mention a character, often in passing, not necessarily fully developed. And usually when he's doing that, he's referring to that specific scene. but he's also referring to more broader themes from that same play as well, so that he's allowing us to kind of have that idea and then we sort of develop it as we go through. The reference that he uses most frequently across his writings is about Hamlet and playing God. And he talks about how he talks about in his Great War with Owen Barfield really early on. He comes back up again in Pilgrim's Regress, then again in Surprised by Joy. It's a kind of frequent reference. And essentially there he talks about how whether Hamlet could ever meet Shakespeare or not. Shakespeare being God, Hamlet being, you know, humans. And he says, well, if so, it would have to be Shakespeare's doing, right? Hamlet could never initiate because, of course, he's a character in a play being created by Shakespeare. And again, he's assuming our familiarity, or sufficient familiarity, with at least Hamlet as a character from a play, right? We don't really need to know any more than that. But what's also helpful to know is, of course, that Hamlet is a play very interested in theatricality and in what it means to be able to manipulate things and be able to control events. So he's also doing more, kind of more than just the sort of name checking. But I think for the most part, in his apologetics, the reason he does it is sort of the reason that he uses other frames of reference in something like Mere Christianity as well. And this is because when he was preparing those radio broadcasts, when he was first asked to do it, he writes to James Welch at the BBC and he says, well, in the Old Testament, in the New Testament times, people could assume familiarity with the Old Testament, right? We could assume that people had a vague sense of those things. By the time we've reached the present, and by the present, of course, he then means like late 1930s, early 1940s, we cannot even assume familiarity with scripture anymore. Therefore, we've got to find other frames of reference. And one amongst many he uses is Shakespeare, I think.
So what do you think we can learn from the way that Lewis does that? Because for us, it's perhaps not Shakespeare. Right. I mean, it is for your students, presumably. You'd hope.
I would hope so, yes.
But for the average person in the street, it may not be a Shakespearean reference. But are there things that we can learn from the approach that Lewis takes there?
Yeah, I think so. Because I think one of the reasons he's using Shakespeare is Shakespeare as a kind of representative myth, right? I don't mean Shakespeare the man as a myth, but rather those stories as sort of narratives which have kind of cultural traction. And actually, because of the way that Shakespeare has been exported across the world, has really multicultural traction as well. And it's hard to think of other narratives that have that same traction. There are some, I think. And I mean, I think things like fairy tales still have a degree of that traction, although that will have more sort of cultural connotations as well, right? So what's relevant in the West is not necessarily going to be so relevant in Arabian Night, more popular areas, for example. But I think what Lewis is good at doing and what we're perhaps less good at doing is finding examples that have a bit more longevity. So if I want to try and be down with the kids, which I truthfully have stopped trying to do because it's absolutely disastrous, then I probably want to give some kind of reference to a recent TV show or whatever. Now, I don't have a TV, so that's completely irrelevant anyway to me. And if I try and give some kind of reference to a film, unless it's a film that has recently come out that I can guarantee my students have seen, the reference will fall flat. Whereas Lewis's references on the whole actually don't fall flat to his contemporary audience. So I think part of it is knowing your audience really well. And this is sort of apologies more broadly, I think, knowing your audience really well, what is going to make them tick and what might they have as a kind of shared frame of reference? Because that's really why Lewis is using Shakespeare, right? He's trying to find a connector. And that might be the latest TV show, the Please Don't Ask Me, because I don't know what it is. but it might be, or it might be, I suppose, again, I've never seen a Marvel film, so I mean, the worst possible example of this, but it might be one of those, right? But it's probably not going to be, I'm sorry, it's probably not going to be Star Wars, because I can't guarantee all my students will have seen that, right? I maybe could have 20 years ago, but then I hadn't seen Star Wars.
One of the things that clearly has stood the test of time is both Shakespeare and Lewis. Right. What do you think it is about them that has ensured that there is an enduring legacy long after their deaths?
Yeah, well, I think it's partly the kind of stories that they tell, right? They're stories that sort of extend beyond their own time and place. And
part of that, at least, is that they're capturing, at least according to Lewis, they're capturing something of the great myth, right? They're capturing something of the story, as opposed to just their own independent story. So I think there is a degree of that there, although I don't think it's necessarily present in all of Shakespeare's plays. But also, I think the value that has been given to them, not necessarily by the contemporaries, although to some extent that, but then sort of immediately after their death, and that sense of import associated with these narratives, has sort of ensured their longevity. There were hundreds of writers writing the early modern period. We have plenty of plays. However, we also have hundreds upon hundreds of plays where we know the title, but nothing else. The plays have been lost, right? Shakespeare's plays have survived. Now, partly that's that he had friends who produced the first folio and put them all together. And Lewis similarly had friends that were willing to put together manuscripts and get them out and published. And now we can talk about them and see them in print. But neither have ever been out of print, and I suspect that probably neither ever will. Mm. And partly also with Lewis, I think, is the diversity of the kind of texts that he's writing as well, right? So, okay, maybe, you know, Narnia goes out of fashion, but people are still reading Problem of Pain or whatever. That helps secure your longevity as well, I think, if you write a sort of big range of texts.
So how do we ensure that their work remains accessible for a modern audience? Because some of the language is going to be tricky for modern readers to understand, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think this is the place where actually Lewis didn't do very many footnotes, but footnotes can be really helpful. So for example, I studied neither ancient Greek nor Latin because I went to the worst comprehensive school in the area and they certainly were not teaching either of those things. So when I read things like Surprised by Joy or whatever, there are certainly times where I think, oh, hang on a second, and I need to look actually at that wider context, right? And I'm saying this is someone who knows Lewis's work pretty well, but even so, sometimes he's using really specialist conceptual ideas. That's especially true in his academic writing as well, I think. And some of that is if you're a specialist on Milton or on medieval romance, then you're going to get it, but otherwise you're not. And he does try to make things as accessible as possible, but nonetheless, there are sometimes times where glosses are really helpful. So you have things like the annotated edition of Pilgrim's Regress that came out a few years ago. That can be really helpful, I think, because that is full of lots of complicated references. You can get some out of it without knowing those, but you get so much more out by having that kind of richness. And the nice thing about an annotated edition is all on the same page. It's a big book, but it's all on the nice same page. Whereas if you're flicking back and forth trying to find things in endnotes, it gets very confusing. So I think there is a place for that kind of notes that explain things. But also good scholarship ought to be unpacking these texts for us as well. And people who are, you know, really spending a lot of time with Abolition of Man or whatever, other people who are best placed to then talk about, okay, well, this is what he means here when he uses this obscure reference to this thing you've never heard of. That's why he does it.
And do you think, in light of all of that, Lewis can still be relevant to a younger audience? Obviously, you work with students day in, day out. Is he still relevant for young people today, do you think?
I think so, yeah. And I mean, maybe they have to work a little bit harder, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. And I think partly it's also that Lewis assumes an awful lot of his readers in a really actually quite generous way, right? He assumes we're going to have read all the texts that he has. Most of his readers will not have. It's very nice of him to assume that. However, that's probably untrue. And so if he's making these references to King Lear and you've never read King Lear, well, then you'll get something out of it, but not as much as if you read that source. So also you can use him as a kind of, oh, he mentions this thing. Let me just go and look that up. So he actually can be a kind of way for you to get to other texts as well. And I think his enduring relevance is such that actually, even if you don't get those more kind of nuanced references, actually the overarching message of his writings will still come through. So you can still kind of get that level, and then you can go back and reread and get more and more. And that's the great thing as well about it. He's someone who you can keep returning to.
Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. Many of the topics that we've touched on today are discussed in greater detail on earlier episodes of the programme. Check out our archive of past shows at premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, videos and podcasts. Plus, if you register on our website or sign up for our newsletter there, then you will get exclusive access to new content, free resources and more. That's premierunbelievable.com. What did you think of today's show? Are there any topics or works of C.S. Lewis that you would like us to explore next? We would love to hear from you. Send us an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Connect with us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @premierunbelievablefe, or drop us a direct message on Instagram or Facebook @premierunbelievable. We have also recently launched on TikTok, so if that's your thing, or you know anyone else who might be interested, then you can find us there @premier.unbelievable. Your feedback and thoughts are so important to us, so please get in touch. If you're enjoying the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it on whatever platform you're listening on, as it helps more people to discover the show. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.